Good morning. It's 6:30 a.m. on November 14th, 2013. It's 45 degrees, kind of overcast. Probably it's going to be cloudy all day here in the Pacific Northwest of North America. A couple of subjects here for today's Wujo. Hopefully it'll be reasonably short. Let's start off with the radiation issues. Been in contact with some friends of mine, new friends, in Finland and in Sweden. And the Finnish guys have helped me a bit with some construction I've been doing. But the Swedish fellows were involved in a study of hospitals from Sweden after the Chernobyl radiation issue when their nuke plant in Russia melted down. A lot of radiation went up to the northeast, towards Sweden, and the other Scandinavian countries, but primarily Finland and Sweden. The Swedish study that I was referencing here was an analysis of the incidents that showed up in the hospitals in Sweden over the course of a number of years, not just immediately after the Chernobyl incident when the radiation was flying in the air, but rather for years afterwards, because the radiation, they had cesium, strontium, and other heavy elements settle in on the ground there in Sweden. And so the information was rather telling. The one key element that I took out of it was that there was a distinct difference in the reaction of the various populations within the hospital demographics from the radiation. And actually, it probably is a cultural issue in my way of thinking, because here's the thing. The native Swedish and Finnish populations did better with radiation issues than did any immigrant group, regardless of any racial makeup. And so it's not a race issue, because they also had plenty of expat, Europeans and Americans and so forth that also did poorly relative to the local population as regards to the radiation. And the reason that it turns out this is, I think, cultural. I'm pretty sure it's cultural. Now, the specifics within the cultural element could be either diet or it could be other habits, let's just say cultural proclivities. Because the Finns, the Finnish guy I was talking to, now he's biased, and I'll tell you why in a second. He's of the opinion that it was the saunas, that everybody who, native guys, always live in saunas in Sweden and Finland. And so he says they just sweated it all out. Now, he may really, as I say, he's biased. That's because he builds saunas for a living and designs them. And he's a really cool guy. As I say, he's got a bias there. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he's 100% wrong. There was indeed that difference. When they went through and did the study, they went back and looked at cultural demographics and all of this kind of stuff. The government spent a lot of money on it there, on the study, I mean. And those people that indeed were part of the cultural demographic of native, what I would call deep native, in the sense they retain historical traditions, into the 21st century, or into the late 20th century, when Chernobyl went off, they were indeed using saunas all the time. And that is a part of a distinct cultural difference between these guys and the natives and a lot of the immigrant population, which has yet to adopt in any significant number sauna habits, if you will. Now, there are also interesting differences that can be quantified and qualified relative to the diets. So that is a huge area right there. So I actually put it down to a combination of the two. My friend in Finland, you know, he's convinced that diet doesn't matter. You'll sweat anything out, you know. And he has all these horror stories to tell you just that that's the case. But I think a great deal of it was indeed the diet. Immigrant populations were much more inclined to buy, if you would think, as we would describe it, commercially processed foods. over the native population at the time. Not significantly, it was about 11 to 12% more consumption of those, but coincidentally, the delta between the two population groups was about 20% of the total immigrant population in size. So, in terms of the most affected by the radiation, so I think food really did impact it. But we can't also discount the idea that the perspiration, the sweating out, the daily contact with the ionizing radiation really did help. Now, I'm building a sauna here because it's going to help Kathy's heart. It's great for the expansion as a vasodilator, bronchial dilator, hell, probably a dilator. At saunas, you get into that kind of heat, everything just swells up. And the thing is that there's a dual combination here. The amount of nitrous oxide in your body, and then, which is a function of your diet, and then the effect of the heat in the sauna causes the veins and arteries to swell up. The nitrous oxide releases from the inside of the cell walls within the arteries and does its job as the facilitation of the transmission of neurotransmitters, hormones, and all this. But it also, at that point, kicks loose any arterial plaques or any kind of a tendency towards that would be reduced. And it's the repeated shock of the, vasodilator effect, and then the cooling down, vasodilator effect, and then cooling down, that is the good part of the sauna. Now, it's also, basically the same thing for the beauty treatment part of sauna, right? Women use saunas because it allows them to, I always say defoliate. Kathy plunks me upside the head to exfoliate and also sweat out impurities in the pores. They perspire, but the rest of us sweat these things out. Anyway, though, in the sweating out and getting rid of the toxins in the pores actually aids the skin in looking better and being better, of course, because it's physically far healthier, and you get rid of all that yucky makeup stuff. The skin is just naturally more resilient, healthier, et cetera, et cetera. The heat shock is really good. There's another aspect of this, and that's claimed. I can see where the logic of it is, certainly there. If you go into a room that's 120 degrees, you'll note that most bacterial infections die out when the body has a fever of about 105 degrees, and frequently viral infections as well. And so going into this room and being exposed to the heat, especially the wet heat that you throw on with the water, and its bronchodilation effect has a tendency to burn out bacteria and viruses that would otherwise potentially cause you harm. So the sauna has a lot of really good effects, but I'm getting it for doing it here for, well, three reasons. The radiation effect. There's no doubt about it. It in some way played an effect in keeping these people healthy in the most egregiously impacted areas of the Russians' radioactivity problem at Chernobyl. And so, I mean, I know that that is one of these two identified elements, and I can see the logic in this as well, because it has such deep stimulation. Unlike these, put them in your apartment, infrared saunas, which penetrate you at the cost of an electromagnetic interference of some level from their ballasts. That's why I don't like the infrared ones. But unlike those, the vasodilator effect is achieved by actually your lungs. The bronchodilator effect is achieved by your lungs walking into the hot room, and then the change in the atmosphere from hot dry to hot wet, and it causes some significant physical changes within the cilii and the bronchial tissue that are not achieved with these infrared saunas, which are like tanning beds, really, without the tan part. But in any event, I digress. So I'm building a sauna. It's for Kathy's heart, for the vasodilator effect. The bronchial dilator effect also aids the respiration, gets rid of toxins, and aids the heart by assisting in the pumping, getting more oxygen, etc. But then there's the second effect, which is the radiation. You literally sweat out the stuff, the ionizing problems that you encounter as a result of the radiation in the environment. Then there's the third issue here. That's I'm old and I work hard and my tendons bitch at me. I want to get them nice and warm and supple. I like the heat here in the cold weather when we're working this hard. Last year I'd had dome really skook 'em here. I'll tell you about that in a second. The grow dome. And I put in a rocket mass heater. Really crude. I mean, I didn't finish it out because I built it up, tore it down three different times because I had some design elements I wanted to check out. And I actually wanted to see what it was like on the inside after I'd used it for a while. Very illustrative. If you've ever done that, you see exactly where your mistakes are and how easy it is to correct them. The designs are simple. The costs are low. I would recommend anybody that needs long-term heat to really look at the rocket mass heaters. You can see all kinds of examples on YouTube. There's books available. There's if you go to permies.com or permies.org, I can't remember which it is at the moment, your permaculture forum, there's a huge section on rocket mass heaters. It's well worth the trouble. And we'd go into the boat shed. We'd work our butt off all day. That has infrared heat from propane so that we heat the objects in the shed rather than try and heat the air. This way we can apply resin and the object is warm even if our breath is huffing out in the air in there. And, you know, it helps for the resin and ultimately paint and all of that kind of thing. And it aids us. I mean, you can work in there in shirt sleeves because you were quite warm. But the infrared heat is a little different. It penetrates down into the skin a little bit and you're warm and it heats your blood and then the blood heats the rest of the torso and so on. But it's not the deep penetrating heat that I would get afterwards, because what I would do is I would fire up the rocket mass heater in the grow dome, and we're talking last year in the middle of big storms and in the winter and stuff, which we have yet to encounter just yet. We've had the storms, but not the cold. Anyway, and then I'd go do my boat work. We'd work for a bunch of hours, and I'd be really feeling it in the tendons and so on, and I'd just go and lie down on the mass of the rocket mass heater for a few minutes. If I didn't fall asleep. If I fell asleep, I'd lie there for a lot longer than a few minutes. But anyway, you know, I take a half an hour nap sometimes. It was just extremely pleasant. I was like a cat on a warm brick, you know, or a dog on a deck in a sunny day where you just can't believe that black dog is sitting out there in the full sun baking out while he's doing a sun sauna. You know, it's really penetrating all the way down into him. And with the rocket mass heater, it was coming up the other way. And it was really nice, let me tell you. It got me through a really nasty winter and some hard conditions with Kathy's health and this kind of thing, because I'd gone out and I was desperate for distraction, if you will, and so I was working extremely hard, harder than I probably should have for my age. And I felt it, and the rocket mass heater really helped. Now this year, we're going to have this little sauna I'm building. I'm going to put up some pictures of it. It's kind of cool. We're building a big barrel. I've seen all kinds of designs from Finland and everywhere, but the most efficient, actually what I was going to initially do was a geodesic dome. Little tiny dome, but then it dawned on me, I'd lose most of my heat up in an area I could never get a human up to unless I went to the trouble of building big benches to put humans up there and so on. And I noticed that's really the solution that they use in a lot of the Finnish saunas, is you have layers of these benches so you can get up at various different layers of heat. That's not really a design element so much as it is forced on them by the fact that they build with a regular roof structure and a high ceiling and so on. And I have other considerations here. We live in an extremely small house, so there's no way we're getting going to surrender any floor space for a sauna in the house itself. So it had to go outdoors. And thus, it meant a whole separate building in some form, and I didn't want to get into all of the structure issues with the building, so I was looking for an alternative. As I said, I was originally going to do just basically a cedar geodesic dome that was reasonably small. Then I looked at various other shapes, teepees, wiki-up kind of shapes, and so on, but eventually settled on a barrel as being the most efficient, both in terms of as a sauna itself, in terms of directing the heat to you, being able to get access for your body into it, and then in terms of the materials involved and the level of construction. Because the barrel basically has only two supporting walls, the end walls, it's no big deal, there's no internal support structure. You just have to work out the issue of shaping the wood such that the staves of the barrel will slot together and give you the effect you need, which is the air tightness as well as, in our case, watertight, because we got to keep the weather out. And then what I'm going to do is to put this barrel together. The barrel is going to be held. It's cedar, cedar slats that are basically 2x4 finished out. It's really 5 quarters by 3 3/4. And it's 7 feet, 7 feet long, my barrel, or 7 feet high, but I'm turning it over on its side. And the barrel is actually being held together by bands. Initially, we're going to use those ratchet bands, that you get at, like, your Home Depot store and for your, you know, transporting goods on the back of your truck. but they're going to be replaced after everything's bashed into place and tapped down and so on. I'm going to replace those with some of the Dynel Dux line, because it's UV impervious, and use a couple of turnbuckles to keep the tension on it. And so basically you only have to build the two end walls really solid, and one of those is hardly anything more than a big frame for a door and a couple of little areas off to the side. And then the back end wall is there to just hold your sauna heater. And then the rest of it is just the barrel. And so you spend a lot of time. It took me, I think maybe 2 hours to run the 48 slats through to shape the cove and the bead. And then it took me another 45 minutes to dado out the notch that will allow them to go over the end walls. And then it took me a weekend to build the two end walls. So there's not much time involved in one of these things once you've got your materials. I got a good deal on some cedar where this guy had overbought, a local contractor had overbought a bunch of cedar decking. It's not clear, it's tight knot. That's an issue. If you build one of these things, be advised that knots heat up more than other clear wood, so you have to be real careful what wood you choose for your bench if you don't want a little hot spot under your butt. So there are issues there, and we're going to have to tap out a few of the knots because they'll pop out from the heat anyway. And I've got a solution for replacing them and this kind of a deal. But it was a real good cheap purchase. You can knock these things out. I think if one wanted to do it commercially and you had a shaper, which is kind of like a super duper router table, so I've got one of these. I've got not every tool, but I got a lot of tools here from woodworking. For boat building, so, I have that capital investment already made. But if you made that capital investment and you were to buy these heaters out of Canada, I can't think of the name. I bought one. I can't think of the name of it even. But it's a sauna heater that mounts on the back wall. Canadians have been producing them for years in this region. They're well-liked. They may be trans-Canada for all I know. But we see a lot of them down in saunas in this area. And we have a lot of Finns and an old Swede community here in the Pacific Northwest. And so I've done research with the locals. But in any event, you could probably crank out these barrel things for a cost outside of labor, maybe $1,000, using knotty wood, maybe more than that by half again. So $1,500 if you wanted to use clear cedar. There's not a lot of wood in these things. Because you're looking at two end walls and a diameter of the, or a circumference of your end walls is, 28 feet, something like that. So anyway, there's not much material. The sauna is really easily constructed, easily taken down because you just undo your ropes and the whole thing will pop apart. I'm not bothering to affix any of the staves to the end walls with screws or any of that. It's not necessary with the design I've got. We'll post pictures and we're sort of making a little stop action motion thing of us assembling it too, to do some pre-video work. And I'll see if I can get that posted as well over the next week or so. In any event though, the sauna component is going to be, I think really kind of a big deal, for those of us that are going to stick it out here and endure the radiation issues. Now, here's the thing. We get a lot of offers for us to relocate, for Kathy and myself and the dogs to move out, and other people want to help us relocate in their areas and stuff. And as I've been pointing out to people, it doesn't matter anymore. Radiation is going to be a northern hemisphere issue and not just in this area. So, for instance, there's a lot of the radiation from Fukushima that initially jumped the west coast and landed near the middle of the country. But even that's not a big issue. The issue is going to be living with radiation because we've got so many nuke plants around the northern hemisphere that are all going to start going wonky and causing problems. And that this may indeed be, according to what our data is suggesting, the reason that all the people in the eastern corridor flee north. And now we noted ominously that there's leaks showing up in one nuke plant in South Carolina. And it is some kind of an event like that. I thought it was more than one nuke plant, to be honest. But if there is some kind of a nuclear event like that that causes a panic and people move north in droves. Now, maybe it won't be 220 million people, but it might be a hell of a lot of these people fleeing north in panic in a way that we did not see in Japan. Japan, where could you go? Here we actually have a mindset that allows us to say, I can hop in the car and get the hell out of here. And so we will see that when a Fukushima-style event occurs here. And we actually think that that's the propellant, if you will, that drives all these people north towards Canada. The issue there is that the geographic descriptors are such that there's going to be very little of it in our area. That is to say, there are very little, virtually no indicators for the Pacific Northwest people to be fleeing north. There are a lot of data descriptors that show people from California that will be transiting through this area and the problems it's going to cause for our local population trying to host basically a population several times our own size as it's in transit in a rather hurried state towards areas in the north. So there will be this impetus from California that will do a small diaspora, but our descriptors are really for a much larger event that's mainly Eastern Corridor effective. And so we see lots of the same kind of language affecting the Pacific Northwest that we do Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, that kind of thing, upstate New York, because these are, will be areas that large numbers of people will try and transit through on their way to presumed safety. Now, I don't know when this will occur. It might be a dozen years out. It was in our long-term data. That data set is still active. We're starting to see maybe some of the little signs of it. Ever since Fukushima, I've given it a lot more credit as a potential reality. So we've, in any event, though, so see, all of this discussion gets us back to the idea of the sauna and the food and the exercise and everything else you can do for anti-radiation. There are some really good articles on Zero Hedge recently about what you can do now to get your body ready for the radiation, to deal with radiation as a component of your environment on a daily basis. I'm doing things like, you know, examining various different Ayurvedic soaps. Ionizing radiation is dangerous, by the way, and not only because of the penetration into the body, but because of the continual degradation of low-level ionization upon the skin. The skin is the largest organ of the body we've got. It does a lot more things than academics and scientists would give it credit for. If you notice the, if you're into the energy body kind of thing, and you look at auras and this kind of deal, you see that there's all these different functions for the skin. So it's really a key element. And the ionizing radiation you can think of is like a little welding zap. You know, like you see the little robots in the automated factories go zap, 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 zap with their fingers, and they do those little spot welds. And every time they do that, there's that electrical crack, and you see a little bit of light, and the air gets really hot and smells bad right next to those things. And that's all these positive ions that are created. Now, the positive ion effect on the skin is very negative. You know, I hate to get us all confused here, but positive ions are bad for the skin. Ionizing radiation creates positive ions within the skin. Excuse me. A lot of dust and chemtrail activity yesterday. Anyway, the positive ions on the skin are actually the things that antioxidants are out there trying to get rid of, because the positive ions go zinging into the body and cause problems with your oxygen uptake. They cause various free radicals of oxygen to exist. And you can sort of like collect these on the skin. And so if you're exposed to lots of ionizing radiation, as are people in the nuke plant industry, they give them lemon balm or Melissa, a tea. Now, the tea is really interesting because it acts on apparently a telemetric. Hang on a second. Anyway, lemon balm is really interesting as in its effect on the body. Not only is it a mild relaxant. It's not even a tranquilizer or a soporific. Doesn't make you go to sleep. I don't know if you could drink enough of it to make you really sleepy, but its effect on the skin is quite marvelous because it appears to work at the level of the telomeres. It actually appears to tell the skin as an organ to begin to process ever so slightly faster in its exfoliation process. That is the sloughing process of the used up skin cells. Quite interesting. And so that's really what you want. And not only does it help with the other aspects in terms of calming the skin, calming the body, and so on, but it tells the skin to work faster and get rid of these areas that have been damaged by the zing of the ionizing radiation coming through and causing issues. So lemon balm tea is quite good if you're exposed to it, radiation. It's good for the immediate exposure on your skin, that kind of thing, where you're in the proximity of known radionucleotides that are causing the ionization in the air. It's not really going to do much for anything like, you know, radioactive iodide that you happen to inhale, or cesium or strontium or any of these kind of things that float on down and get into your body, because while they are ionizing, the general effect is not to degrade your body. If you're a welder and you work all the time around welding, you may really want to pick up this lemon balm as a habit, because you know what it feels like at the end of the day, what your skin is like. After doing many hours of welding, just by being in that high positive ion environment. And it's the same effect that the radiation causes on the skin, just a slightly different cause, electromagnetic pulse, as opposed to the oxidizing radiation being emitted by alpha and beta particles. Anyway, so there's that. Respiration, perspiration, elimination, and urination. And so, you know, we're doing tonics here that are been investigating in the traditional Chinese medicine that go to the idea of the three systems. You know, the respiration, elimination, and urination component are frequently impacted by the same tonic. Ginseng, Shizandra, Ashwagandha, what's that other stuff? Rhodalia, Rosia, Reishi mushroom. A lot of these herbs and stuff that contain these extremely long-chain polysaccharide sugars affect the body in a particular way, where they seem to get at the systems, the torso-based systems, in a really nice way. And so I've been investigating those, because that's where a lot of the radiation issues are going to lodge, if you will. But no real conclusions yet, just trying various different ones and seeing what's going on, both with my body and then doing the research on them. Any kind of conclusion, I'll let people know as we go along here. But I do know that the physical things that we can do in terms of exercise, anything we can do to get the respiration working better so that the particulate matter doesn't stay there, and that's basically what it is. If you're exposed to a particulate that is radioactive, you just basically don't want it to hang around in your body at all. And so, last thing about the radiation. I don't do the wild-crafted or wild-harvest mushrooms in our area anymore, because the mushrooms concentrate radiation. They pull the stuff out of the atmosphere, out of the environment, concentrate it in the mycelia. Frequently, they'll change the stuff, too. Do kind of like a radionucleotide transmutation of the elements. But any of that all aside, I don't want to be eating wild mushrooms in a radioactive environment. They've done analysis in Russia of the mushrooms in the area of Chernobyl, and they're just phenomenal, the amount of heavy elements that these guys concentrate. Now, we don't have the same level of exposure here yet. But, and so far, those wild-crafted mushrooms that I've come across and looked at with the rad meter don't show anything different than the background. So it hasn't been a particular element, but I know that over time that's going to be a real issue. However, I want the mushrooms in my diet because just for that effect, they concentrate and pull radioactivity out of you as well. If you get the right kind of mushrooms and your body is not adversely sensitive to them. There's a whole lot of people that are like that. They can't eat some of these mushrooms, or many mushrooms. They're sensitive to the guys. To whatever element within them. I'm not particularly, and I've been a mycological research assistant and hunted mushrooms all my life and eaten vast quantities of the things and go to eat a vast quantities more. And now I'm starting to expand my dietary basis for the mushrooms because of what we're going to grow. We're growing reishi, we're growing turkey tail, lion's mane, a lot of the medicinals here. Because great many of the medicinals also have some level of anti-radiation effect, either as a tonic and or as a scrubber. So there are a couple of these guys that are known to be very anti-tumor, like the turkey tail, that also have effects that appear, if you look into it, appear to be anti-radiative in terms of the body, not only building your human body back up after you've been exposed to radiation, because most of these studies are relating that I've been getting into are relating to the mushrooms being used as an adjunct to chemo or radiation therapy for people with cancer, not for use by people that just run into radiation. So anyway, so they're in that particular vein, they're at that particular niche, and so our data has to be interpreted a little bit widely, but nonetheless, None of the studies, by the way, showed them any kind of a failure of the mushrooms to provide a benefit. Then many of the studies did indeed show that there was some small percentage of the study group that couldn't deal with the mushrooms, you know, had an adverse reaction. Small. We're talking, you know, probably 1 to 3%. I think 3% was the largest group I'd seen. In any event, though, every single one of the studies showed some positive benefit from eating the mushrooms relative to what the focus of the study was, whether it was chemotherapy or radiation therapy side effects. And so the mushrooms are good for you whether you're going through either one of those. In that sense, that's really the goal for us, is to have these as a tonic, as a preparatory herb for old farts, because, you know, that's the way it is. As you get old, you start getting more of your energy transfer, if you will, from the elements in your environment. You're not generating it as much. Anyway, so there we are. Mushrooms are good things for this. I deal with fungi perfecti. I used to work across the hall from Paul Stamets. He's a really good guy. Like him a lot. He's really harried and probably is like I am, has no time to do anything. But in any event, he produces really good products, and I highly recommend Fungi Perfecti. I've been dealing with him ever since he's formed that company. So, geez, that's what, 20 plus years? We've been growing those kits and this kind of thing with them. My little approach of using the trash cans is really good because it's cost effective. I like the very heavy duty trash cans that don't leach out pseudoestrogens. So I get trash cans that have the polypropylene symbol on the bottom. And you can ask your local guys, what you want is that really dense, thick plastic stuff. And then also, if you decide to give up doing mushrooms for whatever reason, trash can's still useful. You take the lids off, you set those aside, because mostly you don't need them. Mushrooms do need light. They need indirect light, so I keep them in like a garage or even in the grow dome off in a shaded area with a sheet of glass over the top of the trash can to hold the heat in. And for the trash can, what I do is I line it with that reflective foil insulation, and then I use these cheap $3 to $5 soil heating cables, the real short ones, the 6 to 12 footers. The 6 footers are great if you can find them. Sometimes those are as low as a dollar. Saw them at a dollar store once and scarfed up a bunch of them because they're just so small. Anyway, and that's all you need. You just throw them in there. Then set the, open up the mushroom kit and spray it with your little dollar sprayer spit, and stick it in there and let it go for a couple of days, and then put the glass on the, with a lid on it, and then put the glass on it after the mycelium has fully penetrated the straw mass. Or the, you know, the substrate, whatever it is you're growing it on. And off you go. And the heating cables have a built-in thermostat so that they don't overheat. They're all set more or less to 70 degrees. And more or less 70 degrees is what these mushrooms want. It means that you produce your mushrooms faster than if you're getting this the things at a lower temperature. So they'll produce at 55 degrees. They're just going to take you a lot longer to get the same mass of mushrooms out of them. Plus, the mushrooms, by the way, once you're done with the straw and it's all, quote, used up, you use that straw to inoculate your garden or to inoculate another batch. So it's, you know, continuing to some degree. I've had the mushrooms go out, oh, let's say 6 or 7 generations from the original sack before I would have to buy another sack and start over again. And the Fungi Perfecti, among others, have all different kinds of really good edibles. I've found no edible that is not in some way also offering some kind of small or large health benefit. So shrooms are good. Anyway, so now on to another subject. Big separation here. This Iraqi dinar stuff. I've had a lot of questions about this before and after the report. It prompted us in the report to really look for that section that showed up, because there were so many questions about this, not only from individuals involved in the Iraqi dinar thing, in terms of people that are holding the dinar as a, quote, investment, but also from a number of relatives of those individuals who are basically saying, hey, my 80-year-old mother, you know, just sank thousands of $10,000 into Iraqi dinar. What's up with this? And so I, we went in and looked in the data, and it's a scam, as I can tell. You know, it's a scam. I mean, I went out and did research on it, and I can't find anything to substantiate it. The number of people claiming this huge revaluation thing is extremely small. There's an extremely small cadre that's driving it. But in the data, too, we went on out and set specific filters. and looked for any kind of, validation for it. There just is none. There's nothing in there saying that there's going to be a revaluation of the Iraqi dinar. There's nothing in the data set that in any way supports any of the claims being made by any of these Iraqi dinar guys. Further, when I do my research, there's no 190 currency reset of the global money system. None of this is being organized. This is all a fantasy. Iraq is not gearing up and having people come on into the banks ahead of this kind of stuff. There's no 800 numbers. None of the details being proffered by any of these people in the Iraqi dinar movement in any way can be validated in any other source. So it's a single source thing. So basically it's bogus until proven otherwise, and there's no proof otherwise. Now, coincidentally, there was a lot of data that we condensed down for our report about an incident in or around what we called an RV revaluation office. And I don't know that's actually an office that these RV guys own or rent or something like that, but it's going to be in an office-like setting that this particular fight is going to break out, and that's why it's going to be caught on videotape. And that's the whole thing, is that the data is apparently showing an incident in which a bunch of the, let's call them gullible investors in the dinar confront some of these dinar promoters in an office-like setting, and that confrontation is going to be caught on videotape, and then it's going to go onto YouTube. Near as we can tell from our data sets, that's going to be the end of the Iraqi dinar thing as a quote phenomenon, a meme, or a movement. What will finish it off will be seeing these fat old men, the dinar promoters, slobbering and fighting for their lives against a irate mob of, you know, equally old, really pissed off people swinging canes and shit at them. It's going to be an ugly little fight scene, and it's going to really emotionally put the kibosh in this whole scam that's been going on. Which is good. The emotional damage that this has caused cannot be overstated. These people up and down constantly that way. Deliberate emotional manipulation on their part in order to further their economic gains is what makes it really bad for the whole situation. In any event, the people that have felt victimized are going to show up in an office, I presume, about the announced reval that, you know, supposedly is going to happen and it doesn't, and so on. No, you know, it's true the Iraqi dinar needs to be redenominated, but redenomination is in no way revaluing. And if you note, there's a couple of real, I mean, these people don't think this through, the people that are the gullible investors. But you're being told that, you know, something that's worth 1,100, it's like a lira, the Iraqi dinar. There's 1,162 of them or something to the dollar. And you're being told that there's going to be one of those to $3 or one of those to $36. That would mean, basically that, it'd basically be a giant wealth transfer, and it would happen suddenly and so on. There's no mechanism built in anywhere that this thing occurs. The scammers are using the, Kuwaiti, currency revaluation as their proffered historical precedent for potential Iraqi revaluation, Iraqi dinar revaluation. But the situation is entirely different. Iraq is a conquered country. Kuwait was liberated after being conquered. They had to restore their money, just as France did after it was conquered by the Germans. And so it's the same exact situation. Iraq hasn't been liberated. It's still a conquered country. It's still in chaos. You have to understand that here's the thing. At a core level, all paper currencies, all paper debt-based currencies involve one thing, confidence and the illusion thereof. And so you would basically be saying, here I have 1,162 Iraqi dinar confidence votes per dollar. And I'm going to presume that a revaluation is going to have us be 36 times more confident in the Iraq government and its people and its country going ahead than the U.S. when we have a $1 U.S. to 36 or one Iraqi dinar to 36 U.S. dollars. That's what you're basically saying with these kind of revaluations. That you're saying that everybody on the planet is going to think that the Iraqi government is 36 times more likely to survive and do well than the U.S. government. Now, I would agree, if we hadn't invaded Iraq, that would probably be pretty damn close to accurate, because our government's really fucked. But I don't think so. Now, in terms of getting back to the idea of the confidence in the Iraqi dinar versus the American dollar, and I agree, American dollar's a piece of shit. You know, it's a product, I call it the fern. It comes from the Federal Reserve. It's a Federal Reserve note. Anyway, though, so there's a bunch of these scams that are going on out there now. They are attempting to profit off of the natural hope that people have that things could change for a positive, in a positive way. The Iraqi dinar is no different than the Wanta funds or the bazillions of dollars that are hidden in gold somewhere to be hauled out and distributed equally through the planet. Bear in mind, if gold's really plentiful, if everybody were given, say, a bucket of gold, it'd be worth just that. The amount of the whatever it is you can put in that bucket, a bucket of sand, a bucket of water. It's scarcity that makes gold valuable. You know, this whole thing about the mass arrests now are coming back. I really wish that were the case, that there was some, but these all presume an authority that's going to come on in and act in an honorable fashion and on our behalf. It's the same kind of thing. I've got this friend of mine, he's a strange fellow, and he runs this place called Strange Universe Radio. His name is Sean David Morton. I like him a lot. Like all of us, he's full of all kinds of human foibles. Like myself, he's, you know, batshit crazy quite frequently. And but there's one thing I disagree with him on, and that's this idea that the monarchies were ever the on the side of the people. That's a scam. You've been sold a packet of bullshit. The monarchies are only there for themselves and never have been there for anybody else. And they are not standing between you and the evil, bankers. There's no such thing as a constitutional monarchy where the monarch is the overriding authority. This is a promulgation or a variant of what I call the external savior myth. The external savior myth is at the core of the messianic religions, these three weird-ass religions that came out of the Middle East, that the Judaism, Christianity, and Mohammedism, all based on this idea that there is an authority that is going to come from the outside and save us if we are good. There's all these, you know, ifs involved and so on, and people use this same savior myth repeatedly, and that's what the Iraqi dinar is. There is an authority, in this version of the myth, there's an authority that's going to come from the outside and save the smart investors for having invested in the Iraqi dinar by forcing everybody to revalue their currencies. Note that, you know, if Americans didn't want their currency to be devalued relative to the dinar, they'd do all kinds of things. And yet here you have people that are supposedly going to allow the American currency to be suddenly shifted. I mean, I don't know what percentage that is, from 1162 to the dollar to 1 or to 36 to 1 on the dinar favor. That's a huge shift, and that would have to be enforced by a gunpoint on everybody. So, you know, it just doesn't make any sense. And it's the same thing with the Wanta funds. It's the same thing with the mass arrest. All of these things go back to the idea of this external savior. And it's a myth that's been sold to you and inculcated into you if you've lived in any one of the many cultures that have been polluted by these messianic religions out of the Middle East, because it pollutes the cultural integrity of what it is like to be human, because you should not rely on an external savior myth. You should be a stand-up person, hardening yourself, working on your own self-discipline, and we wouldn't be in this fucking mess. Too many people have relied on this idea that there's this external authority, and look what we've got. You got Bush and Obama and Clinton and Pelosi and all these other fucktards. And it doesn't matter what country you're in, you've got your own, Merkels and Jerkels and Yellens and Helens and all of these other people. And they're all a bunch of, fucking criminals. And, they rule you because you've had built into you this idea that there's this external authority that you must kowtow to. I don't really want to get off on that, but it's this. That's why I bitch about this cult of personality. That's why I never go to the Webbot forum or involve myself in any way with any of the bullshit I promulgate. Because I don't want to be involved in a cult of personality built around myself. I know what an ass I am. You know, that's the last thing I want to do. And, you know, I'm pretty fucking sure that, you know, all of these other central banksters and, you know, corporate leaders, all of these guys, they're assholes too. Let me tell you guys, they're assholes too. And just like Obama, he's a big fucking asshole. So is Bush. You know, if you're worshiping any of these politicos, you know, you're succumbing to the external savior myth, which goes back to that whole Iraqi dinar, and it's going to be externally saved by some authority. I don't think so. It doesn't work that way. Time to get real, you know, get self-discipline, self-responsibility, and take responsibility, you know, for your life and this kind of thing. So it'll be interesting to see the fight in the Iraqi dinar office. There's going to be gunplay, according to our data. I don't know on whose part it's going to, but I say it's going to, you know, when this thing occurs, if we've got it right, it'll end that myth. And I think it'll be a big ending for all of the mass arrests and a lot of that, because a lot of it will trickle over from this particular incident. Okay, so let's see. There was the RADs, the dinar had been asked about. Oh, Bitcoin. I don't have time to go into it now. I got to get myself into exercise mode here and get things happening. But the Bitcoin has just started. It's highly volatile, up and down, up and down. As you saw, we lost 25% from 395 down to like 295 within a few days, and then back up to 400s. So it's highly volatile, but that's what tells me it's a free market. You got a billion people on this planet, or 1,000 people all squabbling about something. You're talking about a volatility that must exist. That's why I know all these casinos, the investment markets for paper debt, are 100% controlled, because volatility doesn't exist that way. It's as though we're all uniformly moving in lock sync on this thing. Bullshit. Humans don't react that way. So the free markets are in the cryptocurrencies, and and that is betrayed by the huge level of volatility in there. But you'll note the overall trend, doubling it in over the short period of time, taking a hiatus, doubling, that kind of thing, up, 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 even though within a daily trend, there's up, down, up, down, up, and down, up, and down. Bitcoin, guys, Bitcoin, been bitching at everybody here since, what, 2010 about Bitcoin? I wish I had a friend of mine online had said, you know, wish he'd backed up the truck at that time. And it's like, I wish I had too. I didn't have any money. We were really strapped then. It was a good time for us in some other regards, but that's the way it goes. When it's got money, it's usually shit around here. But when it's everything is going good, we're not working, so we don't have any money. Anyway, so I didn't buy a lot of Bitcoin or anything, and I gave away far more than I had just to get people excited about them and get people involved. Because I saw it as what it is. It's a killer for the central banks. It's the replacement for the central bank system. And so this is a opportunity of a lifetime. It's probably an opportunity of several lifetimes. Max Kaiser is right. There will still be more people wanting to buy them at $1,000 than there are now. At $10,000, even more people will want to buy them. And probably even at 100,000, there will still be such a huge emotional rush to get into them. It is like gold. It's going to be like a gold rush. There will be an emotional component to it that we have not come close to. If we were following Moore's law on this, we haven't even hit the chasm yet. We're just getting from the visionaries into the early adopters. so we're just out of the visionary stage. This is like saying, you know, the PC wave, the personal computing wave is coming, and you know it's ultimately going to end in these highly efficient little handheld devices that are telephones, cameras, and a computer all rolled into one. But you know this is coming, you can see it coming, but we're all standing together in 1979, and you just bought yourself for $1,500, which was huge money. I mean, half the cost of a new car. You just bought the very first kind of personal computer you could get at a commercial level, which was the K-Pro 2. And it had, 2K of RAM. And it had two floppy disks, so you could, big floppies too, so that you could write stuff, and you could write, you know, maybe, I can't remember how limited the disks were. But in any event, you get my point. That's where we are relative to Bitcoin. We're just, those were the visionaries then who bought into the K-Pros, who bought into the, Altairs, the real early machines. And I was one of that group. I had a K-Pro 2. In 79, I had a K-Pro 2 computer. And I knew what was coming. I saw it coming, guys. I didn't have any wherewithal, I went to work for Microsoft because I didn't have any money to buy their stock. When we could, we started buying stock, but of course, we weren't financially set up then to see this thing and be able to take advantage of it. Now, what I'm telling everybody is that, you know, at some point in your life, if you live over these next, say, 20 years, you'll be segueing into Bitcoin as your currency or some other alternative that's going to be like Bitcoin. And, you know, maybe even be dollar-backed and, gold-backed. And probably these things will be functionally the equivalent of personal-to-personal gold transfers or silver transfers in terms of how the Bitcoin's going to work. So, you know, I've been wrong before, but I wasn't wrong about PCs. Haven't been wrong about a lot of the data elements. And I'm not wrong about Bitcoin, in spite of what a lot of people have been saying since way back when, you know, oh, he's old, he's bald, he's ugly, you know, how the hell can he know about these new tech and this kind of thing? And it's like, well, you know, I know how to read code, and I read the code for the implementation of Bitcoin, and the blockchain is a marvelous, marvelous concept. Not perfect, it doesn't have to be, because it can evolve. So, you know, I make no personal profit off of Bitcoin. Yeah, it goes up, but I'm not selling mine, so I'm not going to profit if you buy one. You know, my two Bitcoins, I'm rubbing together and hanging onto them. I'm going to put them in a little nest and hatch them like eggs because they may well be our retirement if we live long enough. We can get through all the radiation and shit. But you know, if you guys are kids, if you're into younger than 40, you're really a dumbass if you're not looking into Bitcoins and examining it. That's your future, guys. And just figure it in a historical context as the medium of exchange between people owning silver that are not able to exchange the silver directly between themselves. And look at it as that, as a medium of exchange, and then start building from there. There's a lot of really good articles on Bitcoin Magazine. You don't have to get involved in the technical side. Just look at it as how the money operates, how that side of it. They're starting to really report that. So, I gotta get my act together and start doing my bounces and, work on my om gym and stuff. And then I gotta go run around and then come back and, destroy a deck and then rebuild it so we can put the sauna on it. We had a lot of damage here from another windstorm recently. A neighbor's fence went down, and so they've got a hellacious motorhome over there. One of these giant, you know, looks like it extends back 5 miles. But it's got a heater on it that it runs continuously in the winter and affects your sleep. So we're doing sound control for that as well. The mass of the sauna and then a privacy fence on the other side of it with some of these things called feathers that are at the top to fling the sound back should control that at that part of it. Anyway, it's been an interesting exploration of sound disturbance technology and that kind of thing. So probably the subject of another Wujo later on, just researching into that was quite fascinating. Sorry this one is as brief and as scattered as it is. You know, basically watch out for the rads, for the Iraqi dinar, and if you're not into Bitcoin, man, you know, guys, it's like, there's that yellow shit lying under your feet. Reach down and pick it up. It's called gold. Talk to you later.